Take a network break. Try our new intent-based virtual donuts. They automatically configure themselves to your favorite flavor. I'm Drew Connery Murray. Greg Farrow is in his palace of productivity. Today's show is... that doesn't sound very productive.
The comfort. Although I must say, I wasn't here last week. And it's like, you know, someone farted here in the virtual recording studio. It was like, whoa, who did that? No more virtual donuts for you.
You're cut off. That's right. Ethan filled in last week. He got some praise, too. So maybe have a little competition.
Gosh, anybody could be better than me. Let's face it.
Not at all,
even
not
Ethan.
At all.
How's that for the underhanded compliment?
Yeah.
Oh, self-deprecating right underhanded compliment right there. Just
well
like
done.
Boom. Yes. I like your intent-based donuts, Craig. That's pretty fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Configure themselves to your favorite flavor.
Thank you very much. Well, we got a lot of fabulous news to talk about, right?
Fab, fan, fabby dozy.
All right, but first, the business part. Today's show is sponsored by the WAN Summit. This is a conference where you can learn how your peers are selecting and deploying SD-WAN. WAN Summits are coming to New York, Frankfurt, London, and other cities. You can get details and sign up at wansummit.com. And you can save 20% off with the code PacketPushers. That's PacketPushers, all one word. Head on over to wansummit.com. And hey, we are excited to tell you that the PacketPushers are hosting a live online virtual design clinic on Tuesday, March 20th. This is an event that has been developed and curated by us, the Packet Pushers. It's got a mix of independent and sponsored presentations. You can ask questions live. You can interact with other engineers and attend for free. There's details and registration information at packetpushers.net/VDC. And stay tuned after the news for a coffee talk conversation on VMware about context-aware firewalls to learn how VMware is boosting the security capabilities of its NSX software. All right, to the news. Juniper Networks, wow, they dumped a whole bunch of new products for the enterprise data center and campus. They've also sharpened their enterprise strategy. They're building it around supporting multi-cloud.
We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Drew. We talked about that Juniper's had a renewing its love affair with the enterprise after a few years of sort of being a bit in and out about the whole thing. And you wrote up an article about this, so why don't you tell me what's so fantabby-dozy about this?
All right, well, first, yeah, we did talk about it a little bit because Juniper sort of hinted at this when we were at what they hosted a network field day. So strategy first, they're essentially this multi-cloud strategy is they want to be the glue that lets the enterprises connect their workloads regardless of where they're running. So your private cloud, your public cloud, across public clouds, they want to provide the infrastructure and software so that you can connect them up, plumb them up, and then also extend your policies and security controls wherever they happen to be running. So it kind of makes sense.
All right. So there's an echo in here.
That's right.
So what I mean is, you know, we've heard that story before. We've seen Cisco wandering down that path.
Yeah.
VMware, obviously the acquisition of VeloCloud by the NSX business unit is heading down that path. All of the SD-WAN vendors are desperately extending their stuff into the public cloud.
That's right.
So they see themselves as a hybrid cloud solution, not just branch to private to public cloud, but also private data center to branch and private data center to public cloud. So I think there shouldn't be any surprises that Juniper is now embracing the multi-cloud world. And the reason why, of course, is because that's what customers are saying they want, because they don't want to be just in the private data center. They don't just want to be in the cloud. They actually don't know what they want. So they want all the things.
They do want all the things, yes. And Juniper will happily sell them all the things that, you know, they've built out Contrail as a sort of global orchestration engine. They feel like they can hook that back into Junos. And they've also been, you know, for years building out Junos as a platform for automation and extensibility. So I think they feel like they've got the pieces in place.
Yeah. So that makes sense. Everybody's doing it. You know, SDN controllers in the cloud to do multi-cloud, bring together. So sounds like they're moving in the same direction as everybody else then?
I would say so. The whole enterprise legacy industry vendor seems to be moving this way. I think they see more workloads going to the public cloud. They have to find a way to tell their customers, hey, we're also relevant in the public cloud. And so this is Juniper's game. And as I mentioned, they also released a whole bunch of new products, and we can just run down those really quickly.
Oh, why not? We just love speeds and feeds on this show.
That's right.
Nothing would make me more excited.
Product goodness.
Good bit of hardware.
All right. Well, sorry, we're starting with software first. Sky Enterprise, it's sort of Meraki-like. It's a cloud service where you can manage your campus switches and your firewalls, cloud GUI. They also have thrown in the ability to monitor but not manage some Aerohive APs because they've got a partnership with Aerohive. So that is Sky Enterprise. They also rolled out some new CPE for their SD-WAN strategy. This is the NFX line. They rolled out a new NFX 150. It's essentially a white box edge device. It's running. This one's running on Intel Atom. That's an ARM design. Got your hybrid WAN. You got your VSRX for security. And they can also run VNFs on this box if you want to do other things besides SD-WAN at the branch.
Yeah. So again, this is that idea that look around the market and see what's working. And obviously Meraki's been, well, a tremendous success. Let's call it what it is. Meraki's been hugely popular. It's growing quickly. Anywhere you go, you know, to talk to people about things, a lot of people have just basically walked away from their iOS investments and just replaced it with Meraki. Entire reseller chains have done that. And that's exactly what it was intended to do. And also, and keep in mind, Meraki does chase out, you know, the low-end stuff like Ubiquiti and so forth, or it's an attempt to. Mm-hmm. So for Juniper to re-enter that market makes perfect sense. And again, cloud recurring revenue makes the shareholders happy. Wall Street will applaud at the fact that there's going to be some sort of rental business model in there. So yeah, this makes sense, I think. Does it also apply to the campus? Because that would make it unique.
That's Sky Enterprise, yeah, it applies entirely to the campus. It's not for your data center, it's the campus switches, yeah, and firewalls.
So that's taken a leap over Cisco's SD Access, which is still on-prem.
Yes, right. Although the common theme is simplicity. The big companies are trying to make their gear simpler to use, simpler to work with, simpler to operate. I think that's the impetus behind Sky Enterprise.
Yeah, and I also think it's interesting, you wrote here, Juniper positions Sky Enterprise as Meraki-like. It's not too often you find a competitor just, you know, somebody like Juniper comparing itself to the competition, but Meraki is a benchmark here, really.
It really is. I mean, it's the easiest way to sell it. Say it's like Meraki. You say, okay, I like Juniper, but I like that idea, so.
That's a new Juniper right there. No, seriously.
I mean, yeah,
normally they would bloviate and try and invent words and then trademark them and all that sort of stuff. So that's actually pleasant. That's a good thing, I think.
It is. You know, it's straight up. It's like, yes, we know this is not the first time someone's done it. And yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I did.
All right, here's the hardware bits. They released some new switches for the data center and the campus. On the data center side, they've got two new switches for the spine. One has got deep buffers, and that's built on Juniper silicon, and one is based on the Broadcom Tomahawk.
Yeah, okay. So the Juniper custom silicon would give you, you know, rich functionality, but for big bucks, probably.
That's right.
that would be the logic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and they're positioning them as either your spine switches or for your DCI edge.
Okay, yeah, where you want the extra functionality, maybe. Most people don't even know why they would, but that gives them a chance to get more money from customers for some fairly thin promises, I think. A bit like Cisco with their ASR and DCI technologies, it's a bit of a thin argument that you need those.
Right, right. And also, not to ignore the Leaf side, they also rolled out a new Leaf switch. This is a 48-port, 25-gigabit top-of-rack switch to go into your Leaf spine fabric.
Yep. So people who are looking for an alternative for Cisco, if they're feeling crunched up by Cisco's SD Access and the salespeople who are overcompensated to sell that, like, I mean, literally overcompensated, they've got triple accelerators and sales bonuses to try and shove it down customers' throat. You've got a place to flee to if perhaps Extreme Networks isn't to your liking. Now, I think that's good. I do think that's good.
They also rolled out new campus switches, and there's links in the show notes where you can get details on all the speeds and feeds for all this. Last but not least, they now are putting their VSRX, which is their virtual security and firewall appliance, and VMX, virtual router. They're making them available in AWS and Azure. And they've also put out templates so that you can spin these up using Terraform, which is the HashiCorp sort of orchestration tool, CloudFormation, which is an AWS orchestration tool, or Ansible, so you can automate the deployment of these devices in the cloud.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice, because a lot of people quite like the SRX firewall. And if you've already got it, you maybe don't want to change it.
If you've got a whole you know, security policy library set up, you know, you can just sort of transfer that into cloud. You get your secure VPN connection between your private data center and the public cloud, and you've got your workloads and policies all in place.
And end-to-end. So you can have one vendor end-to-end. If that's something that appeals to you, then you can have one vendor end-to-end. There's not too much missing out of that portfolio that I can't think of, except for the wireless, but they've partnered with Aerohive.
That's always been a missing piece for Juniper. And yeah, they always say we've got partnerships and Aerohive seems to be there. I mean, if that's working for them, that's fine, but it does seem like a significant hole in their portfolio.
Yeah, it's the old story. If you want to convince me, you know, you don't date with benefits, you put a Facebook ring on it.
If you're serious, you're going to marry it.
Yeah, I don't think this partnership thing ever works out. I mean, look at how Cisco's struggling to get its partners to align on top of the platforms that it's got, and they really, you know, feel crushed. Every time Cisco moves now, they keep squashing another company, mm-hmm. you know, another one of its partners. So I don't think that's a good thing. Yeah.
Anyway, so the big takeaway, Juniper recommitting to the enterprise and putting a stake in the ground with a whole bunch of new products rolled out specifically for that target market.
Good stuff. It was a quiet week for news this week, by the way.
A little bit, yeah, although we did dig up some things.
We did, yeah, but it's not like there's lots of really, you know, news. Yeah. Sort of things where you suck in some breath and go, ooh.
That's right. All right. Well, moving on. Citrix, they have acquired DNS provider Sodexis for an undisclosed amount. If you haven't heard of Sodexis, They are a DNS provider. They collect real-time performance information on service providers, CDNs, cloud services, so that they can steer your DNS request to the best performing location.
Interesting move here. Everybody seems to have a DNS. Cisco bought one a while back, OpenDNS. Oracle bought one a while back as well. I think what they actually get here is a lot of analytics. So there's a few things you can do with the DNS. You can feed it into a security service. For example, if you've got a threat intelligence engine, you can send in the DNS queries into that to get you much more informed about where people are going and things like that. And you can actually then sell it back to the enterprise as a security tool. So you can rent your DNS service back and monetize it that way. And then you can also use the information that the DNS is seeing, again, based on queries and stuff, to feed into things like SD-WAN. So if you know what SD, you know, if companies are keep making queries to Azure and you see all the responses, well, you know what the IP addresses that Azure is making without talking to Azure, right?
Yep.
So that feeds into your SD-WAN. So I think you'll see this happening more and more often as, you know, this need for data and metadata to feed into multiple products because everything's going to be this way. Buying these types of DNS or even content delivery networks, I think we're going to see content delivery networks become part of this strategy soon because they're a great source of threat intelligence data, especially as we move away from all other protocols. If everything's just HTTPS, then these services actually have all the data that you need. You don't need anything else. And you can, you know, one service, feed the data into multiple business units for, and you get value. You don't need to, you know, you're not buying them for revenue. You're buying them for growth across a wide portfolio.
That's right. And Citrix clearly has a business built around, you know, delivering good application performance to customers and end users. So this sort of fits into that overall strategy. They've got NetScaler, you know, as your ADC in the data center. Now they have also got essentially a DNS story and more information they can pull in to inform the data center, SD-WAN, and the cloud.
That's right. So don't forget that Citrix has repurposed the NetScaler from load balancer to SD-WAN, to firewall, to deep inspection security appliance. It's actually sort of a, you know, one of those Swiss Army knives type, you know, multi-tools for networking. And you don't hear a lot about it. People don't seem to talk about it much, but it really is quite a unique approach. NetScaler, ADC, firewall, web gateway, unified gateway, SD-WAN, blah, blah, blah. It's all under one. I think it's all basically the same idea that functions inside a software appliance, put them wherever you need them. So I think this feeds into the intelligence engine of that.
Yeah, I think that's the long-term goal. Just to wrap this up, Sodexis was founded in 2009. They had raised a total of $36.7 million in VC funding over three rounds, and Citrix was an investor in one of those rounds, so I guess they tasted it, tried it before they bought it.
Yeah, they had a date and then put a ring on it just to...
All right, we got some Cisco news, so we're going to lead off. They just announced their second quarter financials, posted revenues of $11.9 billion for the quarter. That's up 3% from last year. Although due to recent changes in U.S. tax law, they actually came out with a net income loss of $8.8 billion.
Yeah, so Cisco's really had a huge quarter here. They've returned to growth. Remember, we've had several consecutive quarters of decline in sales volume. So this is actually a return to growth. In particular, the return to growth is exactly in the areas that investors want to see. So they believe that everything's going to be cloud. Wall Street's a pretty blunt weapon. So the share price has basically lifted from 40 odd bucks 3 days ago to 44 bucks today and still rising. And all the analysts are still lifting their targets. And they're all very bullish on the fact that Cisco's going to go forward. Unfortunately, we can't tell you what actually happens. As a podcast which talks about enterprise IT and IT infrastructure, Cisco now no longer says how much revenue it got from enterprise IT. So it just says, calls it infrastructure platform. So networking and servers and storage and all that stuff is now just infrastructure.
It's one bucket.
One bucket, and it's $6.6 billion. It's up 2%. So you can probably bet, given the fact that, you know, before that went in, Cisco was growing in everything but the enterprise IT, I'd say they still declined in the enterprise thing. But by hiding that away, I think they've sort of stopped saying to the market, yes, our switching and routing is shrinking, and sort of convinced them to keep focusing on other parts of the story. In particular, their recurring revenue. So Cisco's lifted its recurring revenue from 31 to 33% year over year, which is way ahead of what they promised. And the market just loves when people give more than they promised.
That's right, they do.
And a massive spike in deferred product revenue. So that is, they're now sitting on so much software subscription revenue going forward that it's growing rapidly. So recurring revenue means it's just going to come in every year. Cisco can stop working for it. So the market expects them to stop having higher costs going forward because they don't need so many salespeople or sales engineers, so you want to be careful with that. So it's all very much a positive story for Cisco. They also got growth all the way around the world, except for Asia Pacific, not surprising. Cisco's very weak against Huawei and ZTE in Asia-Pac. And their weakest segment, enterprise, went up 3%. You could probably point the finger at UCS there as much as anything else. Would be a rough guess, but service provider was down 5%, and we are not surprised about that. We've talked about that many times across many of our podcasts, that service providers are at least on hold while they see how open source may or may not benefit their business and whether they're going to go continue to spend money. So they you sort of imagine them building up these big banks of money while they wait to see how their open source projects work out and to whether they can do that before the 5G refresh comes around.
That's right. Some other news coming out of this announcement. Cisco says it's going to repatriate $66 billion. That's nice. And they have authorized a $25 billion share buyback.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to spend it on innovation. you wouldn't want to build a research and development lab and start building, IP version 7 or innovations around software-defined networking, or do like most companies, start new business units, start 10 of them and see how many of them succeed or what. No, we're just buy back our own stock because we're so short on good ideas. Not even going to buy more companies. Why aren't they out there buying more companies to grow the business?
Well, they did say they did leave some room for acquisition, so I would expect to see more acquisitions this year.
Yeah, but Cisco spends $5 to $7 billion every year on acquisitions. It's not new.
That's true.
So it's not anyway, I'm just saying that, in the overall picture of things, if you're paying out the money back to shareholders, what you're admitting is we can't do anything with this money. We're so lacking in a ability to generate cash that we're just better off giving it back than to try to do something with it. That's what that's an admission of. And that's not the way it should be. We should see businesses taking the money that comes back in and saying, I'm going to start a new business unit that sells, yachts in Bermuda or something.
Well, I mean, they could do that, but it also, they're definitely trying to put some muscle behind this whole intent-based SDX, SDNA center, sort of rethinking how you do campus networking. And I'm sure that's taking a lot of effort inside the organization. And so maybe that's where they're thinking, here's where we're going to innovate and put our foot down.
Yeah, I mean, $25 billion is enough to build an AWS competitor. It's a good starting point anyway for a year or two.
But why would you do that though?
Why not? Right? You're admitting that you can't do that.
Well, I get your point that you're detecting a lack of ambition here from Cisco to dare great things, but...
Well, not just Cisco, all of them, right? All the companies are going to hand back revenue.
Yeah, but, well, okay. That specific example though seems like it would be madness to try to build out an AWS competitor. Let Google try.
Yeah, but that's my point, is why aren't they making those things? This is a chance. They've got this massive pot of money. They're going to bring back $66 billion. Well, you could invest that in building, competing against Oracle Cloud. Maybe you don't aim to be number one or number two, but you aim to be number three. You've got to beat Azure Oracle.
Right.
It's not like, and that's not a bad game to be in because that's predicted to be the future.
Good point. That's right. All right. Well, you've taken them to task for a lack of vision.
Yeah. I'm just saying that's one way of looking at that and saying.
Right. When you're sitting on that much money, you could go big.
You could go big. You could go out there and make a story and get shareholders on your side and say, we've got this vision for the future and innovation. And it revolves around a massive investment in building. But obviously they feel that they can't do that or they wouldn't be able to convince investors of that, which is kind of an indictment on these companies that lack innovation and capability.
Right. Just imagine what Elon Musk might do with $66 billion.
Indeed. And what he did do with it, in fact.
That's right.
Or SpaceX.
That's right. Finally get that Mars colony.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we've got to pause briefly to talk about our sponsor, WAN Summit. You're constantly adapting your wide area network to accommodate new business requirements, technologies, and applications. WAN Summit is the place where you can learn how others are tackling key challenges like maximizing branch bandwidth while minimizing costs, supporting cloud applications, and more. WAN Summits are two-day, program-intensive conferences. They include case studies, interactive panels, and peer-to-peer networking opportunities. There's a WAN Summit coming to a location near you, including New York, London, Frankfurt, and Singapore. So head on over to WANsummit.com. You can find out details and register. And if you use the code PACKETPUSHERS, all one word, you can save 20% off an event. So head on over to WANsummit.com and use the code PACKETPUSHERS to get 20% off. And thanks, WAN Summit, for being a sponsor.
Yeah. Interesting conference, by the way, because it's just SD-WAN.
Right. All pretty SD-WAN much. All the time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very vendor-centric. So if you're at a point of wanting to compare vendors and see the different pitches, definitely worth doing. I haven't been to one personally, so don't get me wrong there. but I have seen the presentation decks. If anybody gets them, send them in. I'd love to see them again, but there's lots of good stuff in there.
All right, another Cisco story. A couple weeks ago, it was disclosed that Cisco had sold approximately a third of its share in VMware. According to a story in Barron's, Cisco sold 1 million of the 3.5 million shares it's held in VMware stock.
Yeah, so Cisco took a stake in VMware when they were partnering quite a few years ago. You know, it's the standard for big companies to take a stake in smaller companies. Not a standard, but happens often enough, especially when they want to buddy up and they want to get somebody on the board to keep in control. That was back when Cisco and VMware were friends and EMC were friends.
Yeah, this was they used to hold as many as 6.5 million shares back in 2011. So yeah, back in the heady days of potential partnership between Cisco
and VMware. Yes, when John Chambers and the fat guy in charge of EMC, you know, when they were actually friends before they actually started to hate each other's guts. So, you know, funny how these things change. Again, that's why you don't partner. You actually have to put a ring on it to convince me that this is what you really want. I think what's happening here is that the rumors, I don't think this is a big deal. I think that what happened was the VMware stock spiked when Dell announced that it was looking at ways to come back for listing. And one of the things that it listed was a reverse listing into VMware, which is basically a way to avoid a lot of the cost and kerfuffle of getting listed on the stock exchange or floating. You don't have to, anyway, long story. Really, it was just, it's one of the possibilities. I don't think it was very serious, but Cisco saw the price spike and thought, got to get me some of that. So that's how I look at it.
Just some financial engineering.
Just, it's the right time to sell. Cisco doesn't really want to partner with VMware anymore. Doesn't really need to be involved to work out what its strategy, you know. Nice little spike in the price. Let's take advantage of that. Off you go. They judge probably rightly that Dell was never going to do a reverse listing into VMware.
Yeah, that's still remains to be seen, but yes, that could be their thinking.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. The New York Times is reporting that the FCC's internal watchdog is investigating the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, whether he had, quote, improperly pushed for rule changes that would benefit a television broadcaster called Sinclair Broadcasting.
Yeah, well, of course, Ajit Pai is the person on the Federal Communication Commission in the U.S. So this is a U.S. storm in a teacup again, who did the net neutrality thing, right? Roll back, repeal the net neutrality legislation. And there's sort of been a lot of public criticism of him as being a shill for big business who've been basically buying him out. Now, not much has come out of that until all of a sudden the FCC has to rule over the media mergers of some of these very big corp things. And he's been out there saying, I'm a friend to big business and I like being paid off by, you know, just outrageous comments. And so now the attorney general for the FCC, that's the internal.
The investigator general, I think.
The internal review board for the FCC is now investigating Ajit Pai to see if he's actually been on the take. That's basically what it is. Because he's been so publicly, you know, supportive of all these things and said some things that whatever, there's a bunch of suspicious things happening, you know, going on. So if this happens and if the investigation gets dragged out into the public, it's entirely possible that his net neutrality legislation will actually get compromised. Because if he personally goes down, then the net neutrality repeal is linked to him personally as the chairman of the commission who had the casting vote, and we may actually see that whole thing go on hold until this issue is resolved.
Maybe. I don't know, because the Trump administration would get to appoint another chairperson, I believe, and they would probably just appoint someone with the same philosophy as Ajit Pai. So,
yeah, that's probably – you're right, but that could take 2 or 3 years, and that's actually the damage.
That could be, yeah.
Yeah.
And the issue right here is in this controversy is that Ajit Pai was also behind some rules that changed how many TV stations a broadcast company could own. He relaxed the rules and said, you know, you can own more, and then Sinclair Broadcasting came in to buy a company called Tribune Media, which would have made it the largest owner of TV stations in the United States. So there's a competitive issue there. And we'll be reporting on this issue as it carries out.
Yeah, I'm really only caring about the net neutrality angle. All that other stuff is just, you know, U.S. local politics, so who cares about that?
You don't care about what's going on with local news in the United States?
No, not really, no. What I care about is net neutrality, and I would like to see that put on hold. And the reason I would like to see that put on hold is because I believe it will change. Vendors are focused on producing more bandwidth, faster switches, faster routers at a lower operational cost. So we've seen the real focus on SDN and disaggregated software and APIs and all that sort of stuff. And that is in large part driven by the US market shifting to net neutrality, which means the only way you can compete or the way to improve your business is to reduce costs. So net neutrality is good for all of us because it sees the telco vendors focus on faster, lower cost of operation, smoother, better products, rather than let's try and extract the maximum amount of revenue from customers by implementing. Yeah. So I think this is better for everybody if net neutrality was repealed as a global thing.
Yeah, if net neutrality was the reverse of net neutrality was repealed, we want net neutrality.
I don't want to get involved in a discussion about media and press. That's for other people to do. That's not our business.
Okay, we shall move on then. Are you in the market for cyber insurance? If you are, Cisco, Apple, Aon, and Allianz want to talk to you. These four companies have partnered on an offering that promises quote-unquote enhanced cyber insurance with broader coverage terms and conditions. All you have to do is buy all Apple products for your employees and then also buy Cisco's ransomware defense package of software and services. It's easy, right?
I guess one day cyber insurance is going to take off. Maybe we'll just keep doing it, right? I've just, in all the years that I've seen this, you know, cyber insurance has been out there and, you know, you can't buy cyber insurance for security and all that sort of stuff. And yet nobody's ever really picked up on it. It's not, is it the insurance that nobody really wants? Like, except for a handful of just limited use cases?
I don't know. I don't have a good sense of where we are with cybersecurity insurance in the market. I've feel like I've heard numbers that it's a growing business, but I don't have a good sense of where it is. But clearly somebody sees an opportunity here to do some cross-selling.
Yeah. So I guess if you want cyber insurance, then this is a thing you may or may not be interested in which case it's not something that most of us will know. The idea is that Aon provides the professional services to evaluate the risk and to be then able to feed into the insurance policies that Allianz is a insurance underwriter, a very large one, and it needs to build an insurance pool and then needs to decide what is the risk. So the actuaries need to decide that. And of course, Cisco and Apple get to flog their products because if you're buying Cisco and Apple and you conform to the goals that they're trying to outline, Aon, as a professional services organization, will come in with a bunch of highly priced consultants to do the risk evaluation so that Allianz could underwrite you on a policy and then underwrite your policy with an understanding of the risk in this situation. Because every customer is different, right? So if you're insuring a bank, the policy needs to reflect the risk of how much of a payout you're going to give in a financial situation as opposed to somebody who's in a small business renting secondhand cars. So I just don't think, you know, if you're the sort of company that's got money to spend on cyber insurance instead of self-insuring, then you'll know why you want this. But personally, I don't see this being a big thing. I think this is kind of like a let's suck it and see what happens.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a way for – it's interesting that Cisco and Apple really have been buddying up lately. They've had a lot of different releases together sort of touting the joint goodness of running Cisco and Apple together. And here's another proof point of that. This notion of getting, you know, different terms and benefits based on the products you're running seems a little sketchy to me, and I would be very careful in reading the fine print on this. But yeah, it's an unusual, I think, go-to-market strategy, but who knows?
I do wonder if it's not like, you know, they've got a team of people thinking up ways for Cisco and Apple partnership to turn into something real and useful, and this is the best they can come up with.
Yeah.
You know, it's what happens. If you get enough smart people in a room, they'll start doing things. It doesn't mean that they'll stick.
Right. That's right.
Speaking of getting things to stick, Packet Pushers is running a first virtual design clinic. So on March the 20th, the Packet Pushers will host a whole new idea, right? So here's the basic idea behind it is you probably can't get to conferences. Like who wants to be traveling around to somewhere or another and stuck in a hotel and then jet lag and then you're away from work and the boss is yelling at you and the network's down? Why don't we do these things on the internet? So Ethan and I sat down and we sort of come up with this whole idea about why not have a live online event? So Drew and Ethan have been working hard to produce something called the Virtual Design Clinic. It's a day-long event, so it runs all day, just like a conference, but it features real-world design. So you'll have the ability to solve common problems. And then what we'll do is get sponsors to come along and talk about how they would solve this issue or what relates to them. And then we'll have independent people talking about what their take on the same problem is. So you'll be able to look at the problem from the point of view from vendors and from people who've solved the problem before. And then what we're going to do is like, just like you're at a conference, you can get into a corridors and chat to everybody and say hi and meet everybody. What we're going to do is have birds of a feather sessions in meeting rooms so that you can chat to each other. You can ask questions, bring ideas. If you've got a problem where you are, ask a question and then take it into a chat room and then work it out with somebody who can maybe help you out. So to try and emulate not just the content, so not just sit there and listen to somebody go blah, 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 but also to sit there and have this dialogue with people like you who've got the same problems as you and maybe get something useful out of it.
That's right. And we'll also have the live question feature going on during the presentation. So as you know, one of the speakers is going to be Matt Oswalt. I think he's talking about automating firewall rules. As he's going through his presentation, you can ask a question, say, hey, what about XYZ, and get a real answer. Something else we should point out is that you and Ethan and a panel of other experts are going to be doing an Ask Me Anything session, a two-hour session. We're opening the floor to anybody to come in with a question about technology, career, design, whatever you want, and you'll get an answer.
Yeah, this is, again, this is this idea to try and promote you being a part of the discussion, not just being locked outside that.
You're not just being talked to. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is somewhere for you to actually, so it's not just us throwing data at you for 6 hours. It's, you know, we really want people to come in and talk and communicate and be part of a community and feel like, you know, you're not stuck at the wrong end. And we're going to have lots of people in there, like lots of people who are experts in their field. They'll be bringing along and joining in the fun. I highly recommend starting with coffee and having beer at around about 1 p.m.
That's right.
I probably will.
So again, we're doing this on Tuesday, March 20th. If you want to get details and sign up, just go to packetpushers.net/VDC for Virtual Design Clinic. It's packetpushers.net/VDC, and it's free for you to attend. So go on over, check it out, and if you're interested, sign up, and we'll see you there. All right, moving on. HPE, they are the revenue leader for data center servers. According to new data from IHS Market, HPE raked in $3.3 billion in revenue from data center servers in Q3 2017, and they happened to just edge out Dell Technologies, which came in second with $3.1 billion in revenue.
Yeah, I thought it was just a few months ago I saw a report from another one of these analyst companies saying Dell got the number one spot in servers.
Yeah, it depends on how you measure.
So I suspect that, you know, it just comes down to how you define the word server, because everybody spells it differently, and also how you slice and dice it. Quite often these vendors call a data center server is not the same as all servers, or they've got some sort of server that does something unique like cloud scale or whatever. So I don't actually care really who wins, except, of course, the people for whom their ego is defined by who their employer is, in which case their egos will be inflated or deflated as a result of this. The end of the day is HP and Dell are still roughly the same size. Whatever.
Well, I thought one of the interesting data points, though, that came out, and SDX Central noted this, white box servers came in third, but they were actually top the list for the most unit ships. So if you're just looking at the number of unit ships, it was white box ahead of all the branded servers.
This is what I mean. You know, if you're measuring it by revenue, it just meant that they charge more than anybody else. It doesn't actually mean it's better or there's more of them.
That's right.
Mostly cynical and, you know, I like
inspirational
to be
cynicism. That's it. All right. Our last story for today, Arista Networks also put out their fourth quarter financials and year-end financials. They posted revenues of $467.9 million for the quarter, which was up 6.9%. They had net income of $103.8 million. And for the full year, they brought in revenues of $1.6 billion with net income of $423 million.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure what's happened here. I mean, Arista's reported 43% growth year on year. This is not an insignificant.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, right? And you would think that the share price would be holding up. I think that what's happening here is that a resurgent Cisco, you know, they announced 43% revenue gain for Q4. Was this less than what the market expected? Or is it because people are seeing Cisco as resurgent? So I suspect it's a bit of both. I think that they haven't quite hit as much as they want. The gross margin is up to 66%, which is an increase. Net income rose. They're not losing money. So I don't know. I don't know why this has gone off. The only thing I can think of is that Cisco pulled out some results, which sort of say it's back in the ascendant, and people are betting that Cisco can outcompete Arista, and so they're selling. I mean, and Arista Networks has been overbought, so it's been highly, highly priced. So I suspect this might be just a simple market correction based on the fact that Cisco is coming back, so time to take some profits on my Arista, and that drove the price down.
Yeah, it should be. We should note that after Arista announced its results, the share price went down. It's down 16% today on Friday when we're recording, and that does seem a little strange given the good results. But yeah, maybe that a resurgent Cisco is taking some of the shine off the Arista results.
Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah, they'll be fine.
They'll be back. Yeah. Right. I think the main thing here is that Arista's still, you know, 43% growth. That's a lot of growth. When Cisco was shrinking 5%, Arista's posting last quarter, Cisco was shrinking 5% in switching now, and Arista's posting 40% growth. That'll tell you something.
If Cisco's back with 3% growth and Arista's doing over 40, then yeah. But again, we should also mention that Cisco's like 10 times or 40 times Arista's size. So it's also a tough comparison.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true.
It's easier to grow a smaller organization. Anyway, that wraps up today's news. Please stay tuned for a Coffee Talk conversation with VMware. We're going to be talking about context-aware firewalls, and that's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk, a fast, informative, sponsored conversation that gets you up to speed on new technologies and products before your coffee can get cold. Today, we're talking about context-aware firewalls with our sponsor, VMware, and our guest is Jeff Wilmington. He is Senior Technical Product Manager in Security. So, Jeff, welcome to the show. Let's get us started. What does VMware mean by context-aware? What kind of context are you referring to?
So what we're referring to is around this extra context of, you know, our firewall has been doing layer 2 through layer 4 capabilities for the last several years. And our customers have come back to us and asked if we can provide more context around those flows. And the natural kind of evolution of the distributed firewall has been to add in this extra context. And that context being layer 7 context, so around application and protocol identification, as well as identity-based context for things such as remote desktop session hosts. So our micro-segmentation story with, you know, VDI has always been, you know, you can block VDI to VDI, but there are customers, you know, leveraging, you know, Citrix XenApp, Horizon apps with remote desktop servers. And we needed to be able to provide that same kind of granularity for those types of systems. So this extra context now is providing that more granular security approach, even further past, the layer 2 through layer 4 sections.
Let me just read that back. I think what you're trying to, let me try and put this to you and see if I'm right. Yeah. First of all, VMware came down and NSX introduced this idea of micro-segmentation via overlay. And then people have the segments, which is critical to security. The first thing is to do the division so that you can isolate so that if somebody takes over something, they can't get a privesque and move laterally in the network. So once you've got a segmentation, you need to filter somehow. So, of course, that we saw NSX add the filtering by firewall. Of course, it was filtering, simple filtering in the early days. Now you actually have the firewall in the NSX product, and that firewall has continued to build. And then you built on that capability to turn it into identity-based filtering so you could identify the user as a source. So it's part of the identity-based networking that we've seen. Well, that's been going on for a decade now. You've actually been able to add that into the firewall so I can filter by user or by server or VM.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
And then now what you're saying is we're now moving forward on to application filtering. So you're actually recognizing the app. Now, the reason that's important is because there's times when you actually don't know the user. You only have the app. And what you're saying is I may not know the user here, but I recognize this app. I want to be able to do firewall rules to permit or deny in some way to let this app through, dependent on where it's coming from, where it's going to, and that sort of stuff. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So if you know, a lot of our customer feedback has been, you know, our security administrators just said, you know, you guys have done a great job with, you know, layer 2 through layer 4. That's fine. But can you actually tell me, you know, that this is actually Active Directory traffic, right? We know the ports that they go across and so forth. But can you actually tell me and verify to me that it's actually Active Directory traffic? So can we look at the packet headers and see what the protocol is to be able to filter on that? And as customers have started to do things within the data center, they may not allow specific ports. And that's where that layer 7 context comes in with, you know, we don't have to basically set it on a port if we don't need to.
Yeah. And I think that's important because what we really want with security is the ability for it to do what we intend, which is I want to be able to filter between two microsegments based on not just source and destination IP address or source and destination port. I actually want to do it much more granularly going forward because as the explosion of VMs in the data center or even when we get into things like SD-WAN or campus, we've just got so much more networking that we never had before that the firewalls have to really step up to a new level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, this need to, you know, obfuscate, you know, port settings and so forth. You know, not everybody runs, you know, traffic across 443 or 8080 or port 80 or something along those lines. But we need to be able to understand what the actual traffic is. So regardless of how a customer has it configured, it's our job to just make sure that traffic is secure. So that's where we're kind of this next evolution, if you will, of the distributed firewalls for those kinds of capabilities within the data center, right? We've done a great job, you know, vendors have done a great job at the perimeter, but it's always been about the interior, east-west traffic, right? So, you know, our customers are saying, you know, we want to be able to, you know, filter traffic between two servers, but we want to make sure that it's specifically HTTPS, you know, a specific version of TLS, right?
Or an app that we recognize, or a crypto certificate. So it's into a question of, how does the firewall get this context? Because, you know, the packets are flowing through the virtual switch. How does it know to take these rules and turn them into firewall rules and actions? What's the functionality that VMware's brought in here?
Absolutely. So the what we've now added in is a context engine into the hypervisor, right? So as the packets start to flow, we're going to create a firewall rule within the distributed firewall, and we're going to say that we want to filter, or we want to start. We know this traffic is HTTPS, and we're not going to use the typical layer 4 HTTPS of 443. We're going to select the layer 7 app. And as we see those packets flow through there, or through that firewall, the packets are going to be sent to the ESXi hypervisor. Those packets are going to be matched to the specific flow context, and then they're going to be added a flow through. So just like any other kind of typical style firewall, there's obviously a little bit of leakage as things go through. But then once we identify the traffic, it will then be sourced based on the context of it. So allows us to, take a look into the packet header. And then we're doing some things around the extra metadata for things like TLS version 1.2 and 1.0. Say that, hey, I may not want TLS version 1, but I want TLS version 1.2. And so I can specifically say that this traffic is that. And once it flows through the context engine, I now have the ability to level of context, if you will, into the flow table.
So you mentioned DPI. There's a DPI engine, you said, in the firewall. So how many applications can identify? How granular can you get as well? Obviously, you can see it's HTTP or HTTPS traffic. Can you tell me the actual specific application, like, Facebook versus, some Microsoft service?
Not necessarily to that level just yet, right? Mm-hmm. What we can do is we can say that, that this is TLS. So we can't get into the point where we can separate distinctly between like Facebook, and say it's a specific type of Facebook traffic, right? If it's Facebook chat or, web browsing or anything along those lines. Mm-hmm. That's not to that point just yet. Obviously those are things that we're looking into and so forth. So right now,
the same way that other vendors started off with access lists and added application inspection and then moved up into deep packet inspection.
Yeah.
And now application recognition, I think what you're trying to hit at there is VMware's got a pathway going forward that this firewall code is going to build over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So to Drew's question, right, we started with 50 basic applications. Now these are going to be the big ones that you would normally see within the data center, right? So they're going to be HTTP, HTTPS, SSH, those types of traffic that exists within the data center that we would want to filter in on. So the engine itself has capability for thousands of different signatures, but right now we're keying in on 50 or so as it stands right now. With as time goes on, to bump that up and so forth.
But that also makes sense because we're talking about inside the data center. This isn't, a gateway firewall where you're trying to, filter out everything that's coming into the organization with users hitting the web. This is internal traffic that you're
absolutely. Yeah, and so the other thing that we want to make sure that folks understand is we're not acting as like an SSL proxy, right? Mm-hmm. We're not terminating the SSL connection, deep packet inspecting the traffic and then passing it through, re-encrypting it and then sending it on through its way. We're not doing that right now. We're just doing, we're just basically taking a look at the packet headers and so forth and going from there.
So a couple of things there, the fact that you're not decrypting the packets, that means one, if it's encrypted traffic, it's staying encrypted. You're not necessarily creating a security risk because you're decrypting. And two, there's not that performance that would come with having to decrypt and re-encrypt the traffic.
Yeah, so we're not actually doing any of that, right? That's another CPU related, type of problem that would need to be solved. That we're just not doing right now.
That makes sense. So, are there operational impacts to bringing this context into everything that a security administrator or a network administrator has to do in terms of creating rules, matching rules, watching alerts being fired?
No. So, the context in which, a customer or, a user would go into the distributed firewall and actually create your rule, the service section, based on the 5-tuple, right, source, destination, port, protocol. Mm-hmm. In the service section, we have the ability to add in layer 4 services as necessary, as normally the distributed firewall would work. We also have the ability to add in the layer 7 service in the same interface.
Okay. That's great.
I think there is a substantial transition here. We've seen demos of the NSX firewall capability, and it really just puts everything at the fingertips. You don't need to jump out of the network configuration or the NSX as a network to the firewall configuration. It's all in one flow. And that's really important. You don't have this mental context change. You get much more accurate when everything's in one place. I think that's a key thing to me, at least, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want security administrators to have to go to two different places to basically do security, right? You should be able to do it from one interface. You know, NSX has always touted, you know, that we have one management interface for the firewall instance for us to put in the layer 7 capabilities in a different tab or something along those lines.
So another use case that occurs to me is by having this application identification, you also are helping to bring a little bit more visibility into the data center network. And presumably folks should have a good sense of what's going on, but this is sort of another confirmation, a way to, you know, sort of assure themselves, yes, what's going on inside the data center is what we expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So if, you know, if a customer is setting up that, you know, that they want to start filtering out and start removing application traffic that is, say, running on a TLS version 1.0, then we can start setting, you know, they can start setting firewall rule sets, specifically saying that, you know, we're only going to allow these specific, you know, business, you know, the business has decided that this is the version of TLS that we're going to run. Mm-hmm. And so, there's no way for them to do anything else because we're able to pick that information up and say, we're just going to drop that traffic. So as a customer gets more visibility into their network, we're providing that more granular approach to ensure that the traffic that they should be seeing on the network is actually what they're seeing.
So if people are interested in this, where can they go to find more information?
Yeah, so you can go to blog.vmware.com/network virtualization, all one word. There's several posts up. I'm talking about the new capabilities, the capabilities with the context awareness and micro-segmentation. I actually put a blog up today talking specifically around remote desktop session hosts and Horizon. There's another one for Citrix that'll be on the Horizon as well. But you can definitely go there and kind of get some more information.
So that was blog.vmware.com/network virtualization.
Yep.
Fantastic. Yeah, we'll include that in a link to the show notes. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Coffee Talk. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. Are you social? Are you on Twitter or anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Twitter as @vwilmo, V-W-I-L-M-O. I blog at vwilmo.wordpress.com, and I also blog on, obviously, the VMware website. And yeah.
All right, great. Well, we'll have those links in the show notes. Thanks for everybody for listening. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, or rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.